This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney. Recent outbreaks of mumps and measles in Ohio highlight the debate over vaccinations against such diseases. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says people choosing not to vaccinate their children are helping diseases once thought eradicated to make a comeback across the U.S. Joining us to discuss childhood vaccinations, Dr. Marilyn Crumpton, Director of School and Adolescent Health for the Cincinnati Health Department, Dr. Robert Frank, Professor of Pediatrics in the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center's Infectious Diseases Division, and Dr. Dennis Cunningham, a member of the Section for Infectious Diseases at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, and Associate Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at Ohio State University College of Medicine. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And thanks, everybody, for being here this afternoon. Thank you. Appreciated.
Thanks.
Dennis, what is the scope of the measles outbreak so far? It's pretty extensive, isn't it?
It is. It's quite surprising. Originally, we had measles in six counties in the north part of central Ohio. Looking at the Ohio Department of Health's website, as of today, there have been 356 cases of measles in Ohio. It's now in nine counties of the state. To put that in perspective, 356 cases of measles this year in Ohio in 2014. Last year, there were less than 200 cases in the entire country. So this is one of the highest rates of measles we have seen in this country in quite a while.
And if I'm not mistaken, Ohio is the center point because there are several other states affected by outbreaks of measles, but Ohio happens to be the one that's hardest hit right now.
Correct, and that's because people went on a medical mission. People who were not vaccinated went on a medical mission to the Philippines. The Philippines has over 20,000 cases of measles right now. It's out of control there. Being unvaccinated, they caught the virus, and then they brought it back into Ohio.
And so far, it's mainly the north-central part of Ohio that's been affected by the outbreak?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really important to think to as far as about the travel, is that now with the travel, that people can get around the world in 24 hours, and so they can really be exposed and bring something back before they even know they're ill. And that's why it's even more critical if they're going to go somewhere that they make sure they're up to date with their immunizations.
And Dennis, mumps cases, what are the numbers on those?
As of yesterday afternoon, there were 439 cases of mumps in the state of Ohio. Compared to last year in the country, we had 438 in the country. So this year, Ohio has more than the entire country had last year.
And Bob, if I'm not mistaken, I think we've even had some of the mumps cases down in the Cincinnati area, Hamilton and Warren counties, Maryland. You might even know about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think we've had a couple in Hamilton County, a couple in Warren County so far. Maryland,
There's also a question, there may be other cases in other states that came from this Ohio State outbreak, and unfortunately, the Ohio State cases occurred about 3 days before their spring break started. So there were a lot of people who could have been incubating the virus, meaning it's growing in them, but they're not sick yet, and they could have easily spread it in multiple locations.
Yeah. I mean, a mumps outbreak we had last year, not in Ohio, but other states, as far as that it was, what happened is that a student went during a spring break and went to Great Britain, and actually looks like that's where he contracted the mumps and then brought it back to the area. And so that even though you have a very high rate of immunization among the students, if you have a small percentage that have not been immunized, they are going to be at significant risk. For measles, it's probably 90% risk you're going to become infected if you've not been immunized.
How serious are these diseases, mumps and measles? I mean, I imagine they've got some pretty serious complications.
Absolutely. One of the things that I think we need to realize is that measles is a disease that can be fatal. That's a very serious illness. I think thinking in terms of mumps, the amount of severity of disease, there can be problems like hearing loss that result from that. But overall, the risk from mumps is less than from measles. One of the things I guess I would comment on is most of the practicing physicians haven't seen measles in their career. So this is something that there's having to be now kind of a re-education of what it physically looks like and to understand the severe illnesses associated with that.
Marilyn, I take it so far so good for Cincinnati, though we haven't seen any cases in the city yet of measles or mumps. Is that the case?
Right. And that's something that both Hamilton County Health Department and Cincinnati Health Department really try to stay on top of and monitor for the diseases. One of the focuses of our school and adolescent health program has been to really target getting high immunization rates in the schools, because that's one of the likely places where transmission of the disease occurs. So we've struggled with this related to pertussis and outbreaks of pertussis that have been ongoing now for several years. And we're actually looking at the plan for what happens if we see this measles move down into South Alabama, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, South Ohio, and we have to deal with it in the same way that the mid and northern Ohio areas are having to struggle.
Yeah, I think one of the things as far as following what Marilyn said, too, is that a lot of times parents are thinking about, well, these are just childhood illnesses. Everybody just gets them and just that's the way it is. But people really forget how serious these diseases can be, and particularly the measles, and that children do die from that. They have brain infections. They can have long-term consequences even if they don't die. So many of these diseases can be very serious, and that the reason we don't see them is because of the vaccines, and that's why it's so critical to keep a high level of vaccination, because that's the only thing that's keeping the diseases away.
So vaccinations are the best and the only way to counter these outbreaks?
Absolutely. And I would just add, if you go to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, if there's it's right on their webpage, if there's 1,000 children who have measles, one or two of them will die from measles. It's that serious. In addition, if you're too young to go to school or you're over 20, your risk is even higher. School-age kids and adolescents are actually tolerated a little bit better. But these are not diseases to joke about. This is a modern-day epidemic.
I thought measles had been eradicated back in 2000. Yet here we are 14 years later, facing an outbreak, not just in Ohio, but as we were talking about, across the country. Bob, what happened?
Well, actually, there's only been one infection that we've ever eradicated from the earth, and that's smallpox. That we're getting closer on polio. That's a few countries left in the world where polio exists. And measles is the next target for the WHO, the World Health Organization, to try to eradicate. We markedly knocked down the number of cases in the United States, but we have not eliminated it. And it still has many pockets in the world, as was discussed about in the Philippines right now.
Any idea, Marilyn, how many parents are getting their children vaccinated? And for that matter, how many adults, maybe Bob and Dennis, you can chip in on this too. How many adults are getting their vaccinations or have their vaccinations done properly?
Well, you mean as a result of this current outbreak?
Well, just in general, what do the vaccination numbers look like?
Well, they, you know, that is a constant struggle to immunize, because we find that access to care is a concern for a significant amount of the population. That's why we focus on school-based vaccination programs to try to help complete the vaccinations that didn't happen in the medical practice where the child was. Adults, it's very common to do an assessment and find out that they have no idea what their vaccine history is.
Is that the truth?
And so I think increased awareness about adult vaccination is great, because that helps protect the more at risk. And a good example of that would be pertussis, where it's really the small baby that's going to be really, really sick. But the best way to protect them is to get the adults around them vaccinated.
So a good starting point would be consult with your doctor. Am I up to date on my vaccinations? What about my children?
Right. And so as far as just in numbers in Ohio, that we're and overall, if you look at children 2 years of age, about 70% of the children are fully vaccinated. So that's not bad, but that means 30% have not received all their vaccines. When we're getting up to the 4 to 6 year old group, so when they're starting to enter school, it's over 90%, which is better. But we would like to see it be as close to 100 as possible. There's some children that medically just cannot receive the vaccine, and that's why it's even more critical to vaccinate everyone around them to try to protect them.
Marilyn, is it even possible for a child to attend Cincinnati Public Schools without having their vaccinations? Isn't it mandatory?
Well, it is mandatory, but one of the things that we struggle with a little bit is parents come in and they know their child is immunized, but they don't have their record with them. So that's one of the things that the school nurse program really focuses on intensely is looking at the missing immunizations. Obviously, we don't want to be wasteful and vaccinate children we know are vaccinated, but we just don't have the dates in front of us. We give in Cincinnati public schools probably 8,000 to 9,000 vaccinations a year, because so we're actually physically filling in the gap for vaccinations. But yes, it is a concern, and there's a high mobility rate in some of the schools, so as high as 30% across the district, and so that means that there's a lot of missing records. Not necessarily missing vaccines.
It's hard to keep track of.
That's right. So what you're trying to do is get the facts straight about whether you're missing records or vaccines.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
So one of the things, just to comment, is that if the child does have a medical contraindication to a vaccine, that a physician or practitioner can write in a medical excuse so that they can be allowed into school with those. But then it's possible, as if there's outbreaks such as measles or pertussis or other things, that those children may be excluded from the school during those times because they are
not
protected.
That's happened up here in Central Ohio. There were a school in my own district. There were more than two cases of mumps, and the health department came in and excluded everyone who was not vaccinated for 25 days until the incubation period was over. It's the only way to break this cycle. If you have disease circulating in the school and you have the non-vaccinated people, you just are adding fuel to the fire so there can be more cases, and then they can come down with it and spread it to more people.
I'm curious what each of you would think about this. Is it possible that vaccination programs have been so successful and we've seen so many diseases brought under control that people have become complacent? And one of the problems is they say, we just don't see a need for this anymore?
I think that's very true. Our grandparents and those, and some of us who have been in medicine quite a while, we remember these days when we saw these horrible illnesses. People aren't used to seeing them, and I think it's amazing that most practitioners under 40 years of age have probably never seen measles before, and many of them haven't seen mumps either. So there are risks with everything in life, including vaccines, but people forget the risk of disease is so much more terrible than the risk from generally safe vaccines.
One of the things that I'd like to bring up is a little bit about both H flu meningitis and pneumococcal meningitis, because over my career as a pediatrician, it was a part of my everyday practice of children getting spinal taps because of risk of meningitis, and then seeing the devastation of the disability and death associated with those vaccines. Now span forward 30 plus years, and most young parents don't even think in terms of bacterial meningitis being a risk for their child. So we have seen obviously a treatable disease, but it still leaves behind devastation with death and disability. Those two illnesses have virtually disappeared in our culture in the last 30 years.
But I think the complacency, as you say, that's a very critical thing, is that, and I think we do see it a lot, and I oftentimes have parents ask me, is why do I need to vaccinate? These diseases don't exist. And as I mentioned before, there's only one disease we've ever eradicated, smallpox. All the other ones are there. And the only reason we don't see them is because of the vaccine. So it still is incredibly important to have their child vaccinated.
Marilyn, I was
just... Haemophilus influenza, we still see about one case every 14 months here in Central Ohio, and it's always from a group that does not believe in vaccination. It's just awful to see this devastating meningitis that can either kill you or leave you with horrible long-term permanent complications. It's just horrible to keep seeing this happen again and again.
Well, of course, Dennis, there's the anti-vaccination movement. People who are concerned about vaccinations leading to autism or the toxicity of vaccines. A lot of people have genuine concerns about the consequences of vaccines for themselves and their children. I wonder how each of you respond to those concerns. And Dennis, why don't you start, and then Bob will let you follow up.
Sure. There's been multiple large studies involving tens and hundreds of thousands of children that have not shown any link between autism and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Autism Speaks, which is one of the large advocacy groups for autistic children in the United States, their website, they even recommend that you should give these vaccines to your children. There's been a lot of studies that have come out showing that increasing age of parents at the time of conception or environmental pesticides contribute to autism, but you don't hear that as much. You just hear certain celebrities who have an opinion, and that's what gets all the press.
Bob? I think one of the problems is the trying to make it understandable as far as the difference between association and causation. And that's really an important concept as far as when two things happen at the same time, there is a temporal association. So in time, the two things are associated, but it doesn't necessarily mean that one caused the other. But as humans, we're always looking for a reason why something happens. So if somebody had something and then they developed something after that, the natural tendency is to blame it on the thing that just happened. But when you look at causation that there's and looks at groups that have been vaccinated and not been vaccinated, there's absolutely no difference in rate in autism in children that have been vaccinated and not vaccinated. And actually, in countries in Europe where they've taken out thimerosal 20-some-odd years ago, the rates of autism are continuing to increase. So that then you'd have to argue it is not the vaccines at all, because the thing that was purported to be the causative agent is gone.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, do you have questions about vaccinations, and do you agree or disagree about getting your children vaccinated? You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's talk with Suzanne in Finneytown. Good afternoon, Suzanne.
Oh, hi. I can't hear you.
Go right ahead. We can hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. My husband has never had mumps. My question is, he is in his upper 70s. Should he have a vaccination?
No. No, the likelihood is that he may have had a subclinical case of mumps and it just never realized it, but at his age, no, it would not be recommended.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Marilyn, if you had somebody, and sometimes this is a common comment from people who are anti-vaccination, if you had somebody say immunity is natural, but vaccinations are not natural, how would you respond to that?
Well, a couple
tough
of...
Tough question.
Yeah, it is absolutely a tough question. But I think one of the things to realize is one of the things we are working with is helping start a conversation with people who are afraid of vaccinations. And measles is natural, but I'm not sure I want to go that natural, okay?
It's like the old saying, sharks are natural too, so but you wouldn't want one to attack you.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And so we wouldn't have the life expectancy that we have today without vaccinations. And so that's one of the pieces of it that we forget is that, we were losing so many children in the beginning of the last century. And now families are devastated with the loss of a child, where if you look back and talk to your grandparents, your great-grandparents, family loss of children was a common piece of it. You know, I mentioned Roald Dahl has written a beautiful article about his daughter who was 11 who died with measles. Just a very compelling story because he was living in the time before measles vaccination.
Dennis, Bob, either one of you want to add anything to that?
One of my grandparents came from a family of nine, and I remember she told me out of the nine of them, four of them did not make it to the fifth birthday. It was that common to have multiple deaths in the same household.
Yeah,
natural's not always better.
Yes, and I mean, if you look at it as far as for going back to the disease I said we eradicated with smallpox, is that it used to be a 30% mortality. So that, yes, if you survived the disease, you were protected. But that meant 30 people out of 100 were going to die instead of having a vaccine that would protect them.
We also have a lot more people nowadays who have immune systems that fight infections. They're not working completely well. We have cancer patients. We have people who take immunosuppressive medicines because they have rheumatoid arthritis, or maybe they have Crohn's disease of their bowels. These diseases are especially devastating to that group, and it's by vaccinating all the healthy people around them that we protect them.
Let's talk with Vicki and Mason. Good afternoon, Vicki.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a couple of comments I wanted to make. First of all, I'm a parent of a child with autism who had a seizure about 5 hours after being vaccinated with Pactel vaccines. He has never been the same. He has lost speech and has autism and epilepsy. I hear the comments about, you know, the broad studies and so forth. And what I believe is that it is one of the components that caused my son's toxic burden to be blown. And I saw it happen right before my eyes. Now, with my second child, we have run immune titer panels every year since her birth. She has only required 6 vaccines in 9 years because she showed demonstrated need. I want to know why we don't do those immune titers for every child at birth, and also not rush in with things like the Hep B shot right at birth when it's not necessary unless they're born to an infected mother.
There actually are some good
reasons. Why can't we be more responsible with how we vaccinate our population?
Vicki, thank you for your question.
I'm going to disagree with the premise. First of all, if you do antibody or the titers at birth, it's the mom's antibodies that she produces and gives to the baby. We know at birth, if a child gets hepatitis B, and there's many adults with hepatitis B, they're likely to go on and become chronic carriers, which means that they're going to shed the virus for the rest of their life. They're going to have a high risk for developing liver cancer in the future. We don't give these vaccines at young ages just to give it. It's the kids who are most at risk. For instance, the H flu, meningitis we've talked about. That was something that really affected kids under a year. So we give it at 2, 4, and 6 months to protect these kids. And if you've never had measles or you've never had mumps, you have no protection at birth. You have to be exposed to these different germs before your body can make a response.
It's tough to deal with, though. Here you have Vicki, who's seen something very personal. She's had a personal experience. It's happened to one of her children, and it's got to be a hard thing to convince a parent like that there isn't a link, because in their mind, there definitely is.
One of the things I would say is there is so much concern especially in the pediatric community, for the difficulties that families face with a diagnosis of autism, and also for the struggle that they have to try to come to peace with something where we don't know what the causative factors are. So I really would say that there is a great amount of concern. I really look forward to us finding out what is the causative agent for autism, because it definitely has been increasing. And I'm, really hopeful that research is going to help us come up with that answer. I think it would be a great thing for the families, and then also hopefully for immediate interventions.
And if measles vaccine causes autism, then that should mean there's no autism if you don't get the vaccine. But that's not true. The rate of autism is the same if your child got a vaccine or the group that did not get the vaccine.
Let's talk with Carrie in Deer Park. Good afternoon, Carrie.
Hello.
What's your question?
I am going to England on vacation, and I am retired military, so at one point I had 1 million shots, but I haven't had any in, I can't remember when, and at 69, I don't know if I should be getting shots when I go to England, because you were saying that mumps came from there.
Well, the biggest one that you'd want to get, which everyone should, whether they're traveling or not, is the tetanus diphtheria booster. You should have that every 10 years regardless. At your age, it's probably unlikely that you would need to be vaccinated against anything else if you're going to England. That I think you'd be okay, especially if you were in the military. You probably received many of the vaccines when you were in the service.
And I guess I would say, depending on when you're traveling, be sure that you have your flu vaccination.
Yes. Yeah, that would be true. I mean, so the one thing would be, as far as following up Marilyn had said that with pertussis is that one of the recommendations we're looking at now is if someone has not had an acellular pertussis vaccine, is that all people should receive at least one dose of that. And that's something we now have for adolescents on up. And that can protect the children, too, by the grandparents and that of being vaccinated.
I would also add that if people go into their search engine on the Internet and put in Centers for Disease Control and Travel, you can pull up any location in the world on a map or from a drop-down menu. It will tell you what diseases are there, what vaccines you need, what things to worry about. It's a free service, and I really think the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is just amazing for public health.
Absolutely. It's really a great reference.
Let's talk with Ashley and Colerain. Good afternoon, Ashley. How you doing?
Good.
Good. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I have a almost school-age child, and so I haven't quite looked into enrolling him. But I was just curious to know, as far as school requirements go, of how they figure out what is going to be required for vaccine, how to opt out of vaccines. And I was just curious because, obviously, at the beginning of the show, you guys were talking about how school-age kids are really prone to all this. So I was just curious if any of you guys had any input.
Well, the as been mentioned before, is if you go to the Centers for Disease Control, they have their immunization schedule. The Academy of Pediatrics uses the same schedule. You could be talking to your practitioner, too. They can. It's very well described as far as at what time points that children should have vaccines. If your child is close to school age and has not had any vaccines, which I was kind of maybe inferring from your comment, there would be a lot of vaccines to try to catch up with.
And as far as what you need to do for an exclusion, that is not something that comes from the medical community. That is a government issue, state to state. I can say that there have been studies that look at every state to see how easy it is to opt out of vaccines. The states where it's very easy to just say, no, thank you, I don't want it for my kid, they tend to have the most vaccine-preventable cases.
Correct.
Or most vaccine-preventable diseases that occur.
Okay. Let's talk with Deborah. Good afternoon, Deborah.
Hi. I'm a pediatrician in a community health center. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
And I'm calling because this does come up for us over and over again in terms of the question of vaccines. One of the things that I have learned is to point parents towards good, reliable resources, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics website, immunize.org. And also, I've referred parents to Paul Offit's books. He's a pediatrician in Philadelphia who has done a lot of research on vaccines, but also recounts the history of the anti-vaccine movement in terms of giving the information about the study that connected autism and vaccines and how that's now thought to be flawed.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's really a problem for parents is that the Internet is so easy to access a lot of information, but if they're not understanding the reliability of the source, it's that the information is only as good as the source. And so that if you get a source where someone is not necessarily fact-checked or really has put factual information, the parents are not going to receive factual information, and then they're going to be confused.
I'm curious, what about somebody who objects on religious or faith grounds?
Well, actually, it's interesting. If you look, there's no religion that totally prohibits vaccines. That a lot of people talk about that, but there's no religion that actually has prohibited that. Even the group was the Amish, and when they went to the Philippines, when they were talked to about this, they said, well, nobody told us. If we would have known, we would have had our children and our other people that went vaccinated. So that's really not an issue. A lot of people talk about it, but it's not really true.
One of the things I think I'd like to comment on, and Deborah just really brought up the great point of that, is we talk increasingly about the patient-centered medical home, which is really the opportunity for the child and their family to develop a relationship with their provider. And I think that's one of the things that really may be missing in some of the situations where people have concerns, where they haven't established a long-term relationship with a provider, so they're missing that trust value that's there. And, you know, because we operate a lot of school-based health centers, that's one of the things that we've really been working on is how to establish our health centers that are in schools as patient-centered medical homes so that there's that long-term relationship.
I mean, and I think one of the things that's really critical, too, as far as Marilyn's saying, is with that trust, is that we as physicians appreciate that parents do have concerns and questions and really try to set aside the time to answer those. And it's difficult sometimes, but that's really a very important thing for us as physicians to remember to do.
Dennis, last question for you. Since you're in Columbus and you're at the center of both these outbreaks in Ohio, any signs that things are tapering off?
Let me start with mumps. Mumps is not really tapering off. In the past, epidemics in this country at colleges or universities, they tend to last at least a year. So expect an uptick in mumps cases when OSU restarts their next semester. Measles, I think we're at the very early stages. There's a lot of unvaccinated people. There's estimated 33,000 Amish people in the original six counties that had measles cases. They vaccinated maybe 8,000 of them. So there's a lot of people who could still come down with the disease. So I think this is going to be one we're going to see going on for quite a few more months.
Well, thanks everybody for joining me this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Dr. Marilyn Crumpton, Director of School and Adolescent Health for the Cincinnati Health Department. Also, Dr. Robert Frank, Professor of Pediatrics in the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center's Infectious Diseases Division, and Dr. Dennis Cunningham, a member of the Section for Infectious Diseases at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, and Associate Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at Ohio State University College of Medicine. After the break, we'll look at a program that aims to keep talented young professionals in Cincinnati, and in Focus on Technology, a look inside a very curious villa at Maple Knoll Village. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.